One more quick thing before you leave, my lovelies, a message for my heroes, the History of England members. I want to remind you that membership gives you multiple ways to access Shedcasts and the advert-free version of the History of England. These are as follows. 1. You can listen by adding a special URL to your favourite podcatcher. Or 2. By using the History of England app. Or 3. If you get your membership through Patreon, you can listen through the Patreon app. And do remember to use the collections option, by the way. And then contact me for website membership for the other options if you haven't already. Find out about all of this at thehistoryofengland.co.uk/members and get in touch with me if you have any trouble at all. I exist to serve.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello everyone, very quickly, just to say that today's episode is from guests, Will and Patrick, who present the Cloak and Dagger podcast. It's a great podcast which covers a whole load of assassinations, crimes and heists from a very wide range of times and places, from ancient and medieval up to the 20th century. I think and hope you will love it, and if you do, look up the Cloak and Dagger podcast on your podcatchers. And this week, to a medieval heist in London town.
Hello everyone, welcome to a special episode of the History of England podcast. My name is Patrick and I'm joined by my co-host Will, and together we make up the Cloak and Dagger podcast, a podcast where we explore the lesser known and quirkier stories of history. And David has very graciously invited us to come and do a special episode on his podcast. And Will, I know you're very excited because you're a massive fan of David's, as am I.
Thank you, Patrick. Yeah, I have been listening to David's podcast for at least 6 years, probably longer. In fact, probably as long as I've known you, Patrick, which is quite a long time now. But yeah, it's brilliant to see us now as a avid listener. We're about to go into the English Civil War. But today we thought we'd hark back to the medieval period to give you guys a little bit of that, since we've only been listening to David tell us about the Tudors and things like that. So yeah.
Oh, we're very excited, if not a little bit nervous, to be on a much more professional podcast with our dumb conversations. But yeah, if you do enjoy this slightly dumber conversation, you can come and check us out on the Cloak and Dagger podcast, where we explore stories from around the world, but probably not as well as David does.
Exactly. So let's get down to it. So we're going to be leaving the battles of the 17th century to David in his capable hands. And we're going to actually take us back 300 years or so from where the actual story is now in David's chronology, back to the reign of King Edward I of England, also known as Edward Longshanks. Now, Patrick, how much do you know about Edward?
Well, I feel like I'm slightly embarrassed in that most of it comes from Braveheart and other things about William Wallace, which isn't really historical fact, I'm sure. I mean, I guess he's kind of considered to be a bit of a bastard, and he's like quite a strong king, and you know, and a crusading king, I believe, as well.
Yeah. He went out to the Holy Land, and actually that is part of the story today in a very small way.
Interesting.
But yeah, Edward is a king who divides a lot of history, and I'm sure the listeners of this podcast will want to go back at some point and listen to David's take on Edward. But he was a man who was very tall. He was 6 feet tall, which for the time was really, really like head and shoulders above most men and women at the time. But yeah, he was also known, one of his nomenclatures was a Hammer of the Scots, which is where William Wallace comes in.
Right.
And yeah, he... if you're a Scottish person, you're not a fan. He's a bit like the Oliver Cromwell for the Irish.
Yeah.
So he's not a really a
really awful kind of tyrant conquering guy.
A conquering king. Yeah. But he was also, as you say, a very strong and quite good at corralling the court into doing what he wanted them to do. So he was fairly good at like raising taxes fairly efficiently, and he was quite popular amongst his soldiers, which therefore meant he was quite a good king for the time. This is the thing, we're right back at the beginning of the 1300s, so we're in the high to late Middle Ages, so this is like the perfect time. He was a warrior king who also served the Pope by going over to the Holy Land and doing all that, and he didn't lose any territory as far as I'm aware. So he was, you know, as far as it goes, he ticked lots of boxes.
He's kind of that like epitome of like the king people wanted back then, or at least you wanted on your side, you know, strong man taking land from your neighbours that you don't like, you know, love, you know, big fan of the soldiers, you know, this strong man who goes and takes what he wants. That kind of strong man, you know, dictatorship politics that we see throughout history. But he really embodied that and was that kind of guy.
Yeah. And this time of history for England is a fairly prosperous one. Mm. So that's kind of where we're setting our cap today. So that's
prosperous time for England, less prosperous for Scotland, which actually I do think those are kind of counterpoints that throughout history we don't do well together. It's normally one or the other.
It's so true. And since this is the history of England for today anyway, he is I wouldn't say he's the hero, but he's definitely part of
the protagonist.
Well, he plays a prominent role in the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so on the Cloak and Dagger podcast, whenever we do a new episode, we always have what we call a walkthrough, where we take you into the world of the... Because we go all over history. We're not like David, where you know roughly what time period it is all the way through. We go all over the place, and so we have a walkthrough to immerse you listeners in what we are talking about on that episode.
Yeah, as best as we can do. I mean, you know, if you can look up pictures as well, that'll help. You know, really try and bring yourself into this world, because it's strange. I think when you look at England, even this far back, everything is just so different, and it's really, you have to get into that right headspace of understanding people back then, because it's wildly different. And especially if you go across the world, it's a whole alien world.
Exactly.
To what we experience today. But yeah, we like these little walkthroughs.
Yeah, absolutely. So without further ado, I'm going to take us back to a spring night in April 1303. I'm setting our scene in the precinct of Westminster Abbey. So in today's heart of London, back in those times, it was a separate entity entirely from London. It was
Yeah. It's like an outside town.
Yeah, and it was an administrative place, and there was a palace there, and there was an abbey. Mm. So Westminster Abbey, and the Palace of Westminster, which is there today, is actually a Victorian rendition, but the original one was a real palace, a royal palace.
And it's not government at all, it's not...
Well, it's government, but it's government before democracy, so it's they have a parliament.
Oh, I see, administration, you know, the people working under the king, not
doing
anything.
Yeah, lots of clerks, lots of royal clerks.
I understand.
Yeah, we're talking like quills and scrolls.
Quills.
Pipe rolls, you know?
Raven, not ravens, that's Game of Thrones. Kind of thing, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, so we're in the precinct of Westminster Abbey, and the Benedictine monks are chanting the Compline, which is the evening service of the canonical day. So all the way through the day, they have to pray at certain times, and Compline's the very last one before they get to go to bed. And the abbey's candles are casting long shafts of light out into the monks' cemetery, which is just outside, right next to the Westminster Abbey.
Very spooky.
Yeah. So it's like a cold, I'm imagining quite a cold, rainy night, you know? Mm. And probably all the monks are sort of hoping to get to bed. You know, it's the end of a long day of praying.
Yeah, sure.
Doing God's work.
You know, it's probably been raining. It's not been the nicest day. It's been overcast. Yeah, that cold breeze. You know, it's not summer yet, so they've still got like the cooler, you know, wintry breezes blowing through.
Exactly. So yeah, but the cemetery itself, whilst you'd expect it to be fairly well tended, since Westminster Abbey is such an important religious house, but actually it wasn't as well tended as it should have been. In fact, especially the area beside the Picts crypt wall, it looked very overgrown and sort of unkept for whatever reason, which is a bit strange, I think.
What are they doing?
Who knows? But here, an extensive and thick hemp grass had shot up to the height of about 6 feet. So it would have looked a bit out of place. It's like a load of just a huge long grass bit at the end of the like pressed against the wall.
And everything else would be fairly manicured, well tended to, you know, a lot nicer.
I doubt it was that manicured. We're not talking like Victorian cemeteries here. It's still like, you know, they're there. But yeah, so it's definitely looking a little bit unkept. But if you were to walk close enough, you might be able to hear some very strange sounds of scraping and tapping and a bit of grunting as well. As some
okay.
No, nothing like that. The sure. Monks, this is not a monk. This is not the kind of story I am
right,
telling.
Right, okay.
But a little later on, this small cemetery was suddenly filled with shadowy cloaked figures crouching behind tombstones and against the walls of the abbey.
Oh my God.
Yeah. A human chain leading from the patch of the long grass to the gate and beyond, right down to an awaiting barge tethered by stairs on the River Thames. And they were passing bags upon bags, which glinted in the moonlight. Ooh. Now, some of these figures were drunk and were swaying whilst their sober compatriots cursed them as they dropped their precious cargo. And apparently, they might have been singing songs as well.
Okay, this is a very different image. I was imagining shadowy cultists moving through the night, but it's just a bunch of drunk guys moving treasure
up
around.
Up to no good.
This is a very different outlook, I was imagining.
Yeah. After several hours, though, of doing this passing, the cloaked crew melted away and a lonely figure climbed out of the hemp grass, stretched his legs, and hustled out of the graveyard, chinking slightly with every step.
Right. So you've got shadowy figures moving stuff away from the hedge into a barge, and then a man later arises from the hedge with stuff on him as well.
Maybe, yeah.
Right.
And then he leaves. And this, what you've just heard, dear listener, is one of the largest robberies in English history.
No way.
Which you've probably never heard of, literally.
No way. This is a heist.
It is a heist. We love the heist ones.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's the walkthrough. So we're in, you can just imagine those shadowy precincts of Westminster. Back when Westminster was on its own, you know, I mean, it was still quite a busy place, but it definitely wasn't the Westminster you'd see today with Parliament Square.
No CCTV cameras, anything like that?
Sadly not, no.
No.
And apparently they're in need of some better gardeners as well.
Yeah, and maybe some coffee or something to sober up, because...
Yeah. So that's where we're starting our story. Just in a word on sources, most of what we get from this story comes from a confession, which we'll talk about later. No spoilers, don't worry. An actual confession from one of these men. And because of that, it might have been under torture. We're not really sure.
Mm.
But it does tell us quite a lot.
Slightly dubious. It's not necessarily going to be the absolute truth, but makes a good story.
Exactly. Plus, I was really shocked. I like to do... We both are very diligent in our... as David is as well. He instilled in us, having listened to this podcast for very many years, a very high level of scrutiny when we look into the articles for a certain story. But there were very few on this case. As far back, my most recent case, except for one book, was 1944. That was the last time an academic article covered this.
So we're the modern interpretation of this story.
I guess we are.
That's not good.
No, I know. No, it's all good. It's all good. There have been several podcasts have also helped us on the way with this one, including, I should mention, Jammy History Podcast did cover this one as one
Jammy
of their
did
episodes.
As well.
Yeah, Jammy's brilliant as well. Another great podcaster. So check out him as well. Okay, so let's zoom out a little bit here, because I've taken you to the heist itself. But to give you a little bit of setup, we need to talk about Edward and what he's up to.
This is so much like any heist actual film, where they kind of show you all the information. You know, you see something happening, like, oh, how did that happen? And then they take you back to the things that happened before, the build-up and all the plans they put into place earlier.
That's so
this
true.
Is perfect.
Yeah. So, first of all, we had to start with the royal history, and we'll work our way down to the heisters themselves. So, as we mentioned in the intro, Edward, Hammer of the Scots, is up in Scotland, and he's been up there since 1298. So our story takes place in 1303. So he's obviously coming up and down to London fairly regularly. But since you haven't got the Flying Scotsman, it takes a long, long time to do that journey.
So he spends most of his time in Scotland?
Or on the border, you know, sending troops up. You know, he wasn't always in Scotland because the raining season's horrible and everything else. But because he was up there so much and because he was so obsessed with conquering the Scots, he wasn't able to effectively govern from London over that time period. So what he did was he basically picked up the court, which is basically all the lords and anyone who wants any sort of patronage or influence, and all the officers of state. This is pre-parliamentary democracy, so you don't have, you know, like a cabinet or whatever. Mm-hmm. But and he moved the entire administration from London all the way to York.
So he just kind of relocated his capital, kind of.
Yeah. He did, which is a really quite incredible thing, which I don't really talk about that much. But York at the time was the second city. Mm. Sorry, Birmingham, you weren't around at this point. Or if you were, you were tiny. And so it was fairly simple. They had lots of the right buildings and set up infrastructure to take the Court of England. So from 1298 up to 1303, the court wasn't in Westminster. It was up in York. Mm-hmm. And up there with the administration was also the main treasury, because, of course, you need money and power to be an effective ruler. And if you leave your money down in London, how are you going to afford to finance the war up in Scotland?
Yeah, yeah. You can't just, like, transfer the money over. It's not held in the cloud or on some banking app. Yeah.
Yeah. So because of that, Westminster was pretty much empty of people, because anyone who was anyone was up in with the king.
And Westminster is such a focal point for, like, political power. It's kind of nothing without that, so it just becomes a bit of a ghost town.
It does, yeah. But of course there are certain officers left in charge of the place. So you still had the jailers for the nearby Newgate prison. You still had obviously the abbot of Westminster Abbey and all the monks who lived there, mm-hmm. the Benedictine monks I was talking about earlier, and also a fair number of lowly clerks who weren't sort of high enough up to be that necessary, but people still had to function down in London. You couldn't just sort of just leave it completely on its own.
Around
this time there was quite a lot of issues with drunkenness in Westminster, because basically no one was there to stop them. Lots of the monks, including the monks, were just getting drunk. Because
of course, why wouldn't they?
There's nothing else.
There's no standards to keep up if you're not the capital anymore. You're not being watched by the king and his entourage.
Yeah.
Having a bit, oh, I bet they're having a great 5 years of just doing what they want.
But the thing is, it actually became the talk of the town, because there were lots of jailers and obviously monks who shouldn't be drinking were just drinking like in the avenues of power,
just at all times of the day, having a big sesh.
Yeah. And you've also got to think, you know, that garden we were just talking about, the cemetery being overgrown.
Oh, they're not doing their job. No. Oh my god, they're just letting things out, you know, overgrow everywhere.
I guess the royal gardener had gone up to York with the
king. Oh god, they can't. Oh, I bet they're just so like happy with themselves. Like, they're people are complaining, going, oh, he took the gardeners as well. Like,
yeah, what can we do?
You haven't been cleaning anything. Yeah, he took the cleaners as well. Yeah, yeah, there was. We had cleaners and gardeners and everything.
They'll come back. Yeah, they'll come back. It's fine. We've got time. But yeah, so whilst the main treasury was all the way up in York, the king had a second treasury. And this was called the Treasury of the Royal Wardrobe.
Good, because he's got a lot of clothes, I assume, you know.
Well, exactly. He had, it was basically like a personal piggy bank to clothe and supply him with armour, the king armour, but also the courtiers as well. So if he wanted everyone to wear the same thing, he'd
be like... So it's not like the national treasure bank, it's his personal spending money, kind of.
Yeah, but also think of it more like the gold reserve, because he also, it wasn't just, you know, a bit of, you know, sacks of coins and things like that.
Oh, it was the kind of more, you know, fancy treasure. It was stuff that he could also be wearing as well. Like,
yeah, it showed the prestige of England or the royal house. So there were, like, you know, decorative swords, and I think King Arthur's sword might have been in there. And
King Arthur's sword?
It was so called. Or I think there were a couple of other...
As in Excalibur.
as in Excalibur. In fact, I know what happened to that sword. Actually, that's not from this bit. Anyway, it doesn't matter. That sword actually had already gone.
Is there a real Excalibur?
Well, complete tangent here, but I know it wasn't in the vault by then, because Richard the Lionheart, who was three kings before Edward, mm-hmm. had given it on his way to crusade to the Duke of Sicily.
He gave King Arthur's sword.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a nice, pretty good present.
I know.
Isn't that sword supposed to declare you're the King of England?
I know, I have no idea. I mean, obviously, I'm sure it wasn't the sword, or if ever there was
I'm not sure if there was a the sword, the one that was in stone and then Arthur drew it out. Yeah, I don't know if that's...
That actually made out. I don't mean,
Did he get it out of a stone, but he also got given it by the Lady of the Lake or something?
It depends on the legend. It depends. There's so many different variations of King Arthur.
Right, but he's left that sword back in Westminster.
That's already gone. That's gone. Richard the Lionheart was three before.
Yeah, of course.
But there were other things in
any other magical sword he has on hand, he might have as well, you know.
Things you can't, like, melt down for their value because they have more value being held together as a sword. Do you see what I mean?
Right. And it's, you know, it's unhelpful stuff to pay with because it's got kind of vague value. You know, you have to have it appraised every now and again.
It's like, what will you give that for? How much are you going to give me for that?
Yeah. It just doesn't quite, like, you know, it's not sacks of coins that all stack up and you can
pass
them over.
But there was a lot of that as well. Lots of jewels, lots of, like, plate. You know, silver plates
silverware,
and stuff.
So yeah,
you can't really sell that. I mean, you could, but it's like, you know.
How nice would this stuff be by today's standard? Because probably not that nice, actually, would it?
No, well, no, they would have been pretty nice.
Yeah?
Yeah. It would have been like, because you weren't...
I'm not saying I would say no to it if I was offered, you know, if I was offered one of these swords. But, like, they're not the most amazing
stuff. Remember what I said. This is one of the biggest heists in history.
Right.
So there's a lot of money in there, or, like, value.
Yeah, I suppose. And I suppose a lot of it is just precious metals and precious stones, which are the same. No matter where, you know, they've been the same for millions of years. So regardless, it's still valuable stuff.
Exactly. So this sort of treasure trove was kept in the crypt, the Pyx crypt, P-Y-X, Pyx crypt, in Westminster Abbey, in just below the Chapter House in Westminster Abbey, right next to the Monk Cemetery.
The Drunk Monks.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
But I guess no one expected anyone to try and nick stuff from there, especially whilst the king was away. I think no one really was, like, sort of keeping an eye out.
That seems odd. And they put it in the crypts because, is that a normal place to put your treasure?
It's quite a good strong place to...
It's naturally going to be quite an easy place to defend and will have lots of thick walls. And then also people don't break into crypts because of ghosts.
Well, and also just being... Back then, everyone is much more religious than they are today.
Yeah.
And so it would have been a bit God-fearing as well. You wouldn't want to steal from the church.
Sure.
Maybe.
Sure. Absolutely
know.
Not.
It sort of works.
Yeah, because that doesn't happen, stealing from churches. Yeah,
it never happens. But anyway, yeah, so you've got the king up in Scotland with basically everyone who's anyone. All the B-listers are down in London looking after a treasury which they aren't doing a very good job with. And in enters our real protagonist of today's episode, Richard of Pudlicott.
Great name.
What a name.
Love it. Richard of Pudlicott.
Yes.
Where is Pudlicott?
Oxfordshire.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, it's very nice. Yeah. If you can get there, you know, this is lovely.
Yeah.
So Richard was a member of the gentry. And the gentry, for those listeners who don't know, is something that wasn't really a lord, but you weren't a tenant farmer. So you were sort of like merchant class.
Early middle class, but not quite at middle class.
Yeah, like they wanted to be.
Centuries off.
Yeah, they wanted to be nobility, but hadn't quite made it.
Yes.
But they weren't.
A bit more than... Were they kind of working? Were they money people? You know, did they have trades and stuff like that?
Yeah, they would have. But it would depend on, you know, it's quite a sort of catch-all phrase, gentry, so it depends who you are. Mm-hmm. But I reckon there was a couple of, you know, they were wearing stockings, but they weren't wearing the ruff.
Around
the neck.
As a family, they might have one or two pieces of fine jewellery that they only bring out at special occasions and stuff, yeah.
And they would have a shield, but it would be, you know, no one's ever heard of them kind of thing. You know. So Richard of Pudlicott is the man of the moment, and he is the Danny Ocean of this particular heist.
Right, okay. So I'm just going to imagine George Clooney for this.
That's fine. George Clooney in stockings and has like a hood.
They should do an Ocean's film that's set in medieval times.
They should. That
would be great.
So funny. So Richard, as I said, was gentry. But he'd sort of been able, because he had a bit of social mobility, it meant he kind of... I wouldn't call him an entrepreneur. He was more like a failed businessman.
Right. Perfect level in society to be a heist man. Isn't
it really
it?
That, is.
You know, you can schmooze with everyone. You can talk to working class people, and you can schmooze with the higher ups as well.
I completely agree. He is perfectly placed to be this role.
And it's also the sort of person who would think to do it as well, because he can see the life he could have. You know, if you're right at the bottom and you're a peasant, you could never have that money. So even if you stole it, no one would buy it off you because they were like, this is obviously stolen. You could never spend it. It won't help you in life, really.
Very
Whereas
true.
He is at a point where there's a lot of, well, there could be social mobility. You know, he could rise.
Yeah.
All he needs is a bit of money.
But he might also have been, because there is a little bit of that. So what is the motive? Why is he going after this money? Apart from obviously
money
yeah. right? But, you know, if you get caught, that's treason. Hang, drawn and quartered. No questions asked.
Right.
So, you know, it's quite a big gamble to just, why not rob, you know, someone else?
Yeah, why rob the king?
Exactly.
And especially this king, who does not seem like the nicest guy and seems like he would probably take it quite badly if you nicked from him.
He would. Well, The answer to those questions is a little bit shrouded in history, but we just have to look at Richard of Pudlicott's CV to have a little bit of an inkling as to why he was.
It's fantastic we've got his CV. That's
oh,
really
it's brilliant.
Amazing. Yeah,
it's amazing what you can find in the
National
Archives.
Who was he applying to that we got the CV?
Well, he started off life, as I say, in Pudlicott, which is a tiny little village in Oxfordshire, but he went to make his fortune. He left Pudlicott and came to none other than the Palace of Westminster, where he worked as a royal clerk.
Oh, inside job.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
Exactly. So he started off work there, but he wasn't brilliant at it. He wasn't a good administrator.
Do we know, because the term clerk is used so often, is it a catch-all term for lots of different jobs? And it basically means you could probably write, read, and add up. And so you did anything that vaguely needed those things, like check through these documents, see if all these taxes have come in, or check through these documents and see what letters are coming in. Like, it's kind of anything
that's
not manual labour, really.
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Now, I don't know which order he worked. I'm pretty sure he started as the clerk, but then left. He left the service.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he knows, like, the schematics of the building.
He knows the inside. He knows who to talk to.
Exactly.
He knows where the weak points are.
Yeah. So, but after that, he then goes on the road as a travelling salesman.
Oh, it's so perfect.
Or a travelling merchant.
Oh, so he knows how to talk to people. He knows how to manipulate. It's finding it hard to root for this guy. I mean, he is committing a crime, but
who's actually getting hurt?
It's a cool crime, isn't it? It's one of the cool ones.
Yeah, it is. Well, he, as I say, so he went on the road, started off as a butter merchant, which seems like a really odd...
butter. So he'd go around selling, so he'd buy butter from a farm and then travel.
I suppose so, but
that's an odd thing.
Pre-refrigeration, that's a hard business.
Yeah, maybe very salted, but that wouldn't stop it melting or I don't know. That's a weird one. Because also, you'd assume you'd get butter from a farm. You wouldn't buy it off someone who's travelled a few hundred miles to bring it to you. You get it from your local farm.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. But anyway, what he then went into, because he left the butter trade fairly quickly, he went into being a wool merchant. Now, this makes much more sense because at the time, as History of England listeners will know, the main principal export that we had as a nation was wool.
Absolutely.
All the way over the channel, not that far, to Antwerp, which was the wool market of the whole of Europe, and also the cloth trade. So you had a lot of business going on there. Mm-hmm. And quite intermittently, the Spanish, when they controlled the Spanish Netherlands, or Flanders as it was as well, they would close the ports to England, and then it would be like mutual destruction for their economies because they needed each other to work. So then they'd open them again, and then it would all be fine again. It's a bit like Brexit.
And a bit like other political events that are happening at the moment, but more around oil. But we won't dive into that.
No, we will not. But yeah, so he then went into the wool trade, and it seemed to be going fairly well for him. And he was in Flanders quite a lot, which is where Antwerp is. Mm. And but this is where the motive might come in.
Okay.
Because Edward's wars were costing so much money, he'd been raising a lot of taxes. And the taxation was so high that it might have run him out of business as a butter merchant.
Ah, I see.
So then when he goes into the wool trade, he's thinking, okay, well, this can't fail. It's too big to fail. But would you believe it? He's over in Antwerp, probably selling a few sheep or sheepskins, and he gets arrested.
Ooh, okay.
So what's he done? Richard of Pudlicott, at the moment, stand up gent, literally, gentry, and he hasn't got any, you know, he hasn't done anything wrong yet. But it turns out that he has been arrested alongside some of his other fellow merchants as surety for King Edward's loans which he hasn't paid back to Antwerp.
So he's not done anything. He is paying the punishment for his king's poor money management.
Yeah.
And massive spending in Scotland.
Absolutely.
Wow, God, yeah. That's
so you'd be pissed.
That's really awful. Really kind of, he's having his life ruined. He's being smart, he's being entrepreneurial.
He's trying to survive in this high tax world.
Yeah, exactly. He's doing a great job. Wow, that's so interesting. Yeah. I mean, I guess it makes sense. But then is that going to do anything to Edward? Does he care? Or is he like gotten away with that?
Edward does not give a shit.
Wow, that's... Oh, yeah, sure. I'm really sad you arrested those random...
Richard of Pudlicott. Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
Hit me where I hurt. Jeez. Yeah. One of the clerks from Westminster. Oh, yeah, that place. I remember work being there. Yeah,
yeah, like I have 1,500 clerks with me. I don't know why I'd care about one. But whatever happened, Richard does get out. But okay. It's not quite sure how. I'm supposed he either bribes someone or they just let him go.
Because he figures out a way out.
Yeah. So he's then back in London. And he hasn't got that much on.
He's had his life ruined by the king.
Yeah, exactly. And one day, he was walking through Westminster, which is his old haunt. He has his mates down the road. And he is actually on the way to the pub.
Classic.
To see some of his mates.
Nice. Smart.
And he notices a window with a ladder next to it. At the Palace of Westminster, right by the crypt, where the main heist will happen later.
Mm-hmm.
And so, being the Chancellor entrepreneur that he is, and knowing that the King is all the way up in Scotland, this is about 3 months before the heist in April, he shimmies up this ladder.
Opportunistic.
He really is. And he looks in the window, and he sees it's just held in by a string, just like a cord. Like
what is
the window? So he can get in really easily.
The window is held in by a cord?
Yeah, that's what it says in the confession, because this comes up later. So there's like I'm guessing it's like a drawstring, which is so like the window's on a hinge, like a normal window, but it's being held together with a tied bit of knot.
Oh, I see. It's closed shut by a piece of string.
Yeah, basically.
Smart. But yeah. I suppose, they're not great at windows at this time. You know, they don't have double glaze, you know, click locking and you know that sort of thing.
Yeah, and no burglar alarms either.
No burglar alarms. Yeah.
But anyway, so he then opens this window and climbs in, and finds himself in the chapter house. No guards around. Mm-hmm. Couple of monks around, but they don't see him. And why would they care? He's a royal clerk. He's known around the place anyway.
They're all smashed as well. So
yeah, or they're praying or whatever. Mm. So he then sees. He panics a little bit because he doesn't stay long. He sees on like a sideboard a nice silver platter, so he goes, I'm having that.
Oh god, just think it in that moment. He's like, he just looks at his life. I imagine everything is flowing through his mind. Like, he's tried to live on the straight and narrow, he's gone through butter sales, which that's good.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's deep trauma, probably from those days.
It's like telemarketing.
And then he had a brief taste of the high life of being a wool merchant in Amsterdam and then in the Netherlands. And then that's all snatched away by this bastard of a king who just doesn't care about his people. Well, maybe a bit mean, but in the story, he's a real villain. Maybe he's also half Scottish. No, that's probably a bit much. But in that moment, he's like. And he wouldn't notice.
Well, also, he's hard up, so he needs to make money. Like, he really needs it. So he takes this plate, this platter, and then goes out the same way he came in. So you just imagine, if you pass by, you'd see him coming down this ladder holding a silver plate in his
hand. But it's that kind of thing where, like, if it's, like, the middle of the day, or even if you just do it blatantly, and you do it with confidence, he's just moving things.
Yeah, exactly. So he does that, leaves, and then, presumably sells this thing.
Does he go to the pub first?
I'm not sure.
Can I order a meal? Can I have it on this plate, please?
Yes, on this silver platter, please. Which says quite clearly, Edward Regnus.
Yeah,
on
yeah.
To
Edward, happy birthday.
From Louis.
Yeah, yeah.
Kisses.
From Louis.
Yeah.
Who's Edward? Ah, he's a neighbour of mine. Yeah, ignore that.
Yeah. So anyway, he then sells on this to a fence, presumably. He sells on this piece of plate. But he doesn't make loads of money from it because it is just a piece of silver. So it's not going to make him rich.
It's a gateway theft.
And exactly, he now realises how unguarded this place is. And of course, he knows that where the treasury of the wardrobe is located.
Right, so it's just a clear shot for him.
Yeah, but he realises, I mean, I'm guessing he realises, this is a little bit of poetic licence, that he can't get down to the crypt from that window. You know, he couldn't, because there's not always a ladder there. And there are guards outside.
Yeah, it's not completely
left on its own.
And also, I assume, like, that route in is not necessarily his idea of this is the perfect heist. It's more about alerting him to the fact of how unguarded this treasure is, and he knows that, and he knows it's so close.
Exactly.
He can get it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just within his grasp, you know?
Yes.
So he also realised that if he's going to make real money, he's going to need a crew.
Of course he needs a crew. Yeah, 100%.
And where is he going to find this crew? At the pub.
Because he's obviously... there we go.
He's been around. He knows these pubs.
I doubt this is true, but I'm imagining it's also that night. So he's wandering back and people are checking out that plate going, well, let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Let me try. Innkeep, can I have a back room? I need a back room.
Yeah, just imagine him going into like a tavern, like stinks of the Thames because they haven't sorted out the sewage or whatever. And they go into this smoky pub and it's in the back room and you've got the candle lights and then,
you
know, this guy's like sharpening knives in one corner and like throwing darts.
Oh, 100%. Guy with a black eye. There's someone playing, I was going to say piano, they don't have them at that point, but
harpsichord.
I'm imagining it's a real dive as well. It's not like the nice pub, it's not the nice tavern where honorable people go. It's the kind of
CD. The spoons.
Yeah, it's the spoons. Yeah. Exactly. Now, at this point in a heist film, which I think is where I'm putting in my expertise into this, the crew they need to gather, all their skills will be, it's almost like Chekhov's skills, where they happen to find the people who just happen to have the perfect skills that will weirdly line up to exactly what they want. Is that what he does?
Oh my God, yes it is.
Oh my God, no way.
So, here's the time to meet the crew. They're going to pull off this. No, let's call it. So not Ocean's 11. It will be Richard.
Ocean's 13-11.
Ocean's 13-11. That's good. Yeah. I was trying to think like Richard of Pudlicott's 4.
It's only 4.
Well, we only know about 3. Well, apart from Richard himself, we know about 3 accomplice names. Mm-hmm. But there was probably, historians estimate, and also if you just do it logically, more in the region of 15 to 20 of them.
Right.
Because for the amount they steal, they literally couldn't do it with 4 people. It would take too long. Mm-hmm. So, the ones we know of, obviously, you know, Richard is the main man. He's the ideas guy.
Oceans.
He's the chancellor. Yeah, exactly. So, they have to think this through very carefully. If they can't get in through a window, how do you get in? Do you build a tunnel? Probably not, because you're by the Thames, and that would take a long time and people would notice. Mm-hmm. So, how about going through the outside wall?
Going through the outside
through
wall?
Through it, yes.
Right.
So how are you going to get through a wall? It's 13 inches of stone.
I would normally say explosives, but that doesn't exist yet.
Well, it does, but just not in this part of the world.
Right, okay, yeah. I mean, you know, that would be the anachronistic part of the film of this version.
Dynamite.
Yeah, dynamite. They get some sort of Chinese firework explosives.
Yeah.
A drill?
Again, dude, way too early. No.
But I mean... I don't mean an electric drill. I meant like, you know, the
get
kind of
hammer
carpenter drill.
Drill,
you know, the ones where they just wind it around.
Well, that's more likely. So yes, he needed a mason, a master mason.
Ah, right.
Which there are loads of those around.
Yeah.
So John of St. Albans.
Love it.
Is his mason man.
Right, okay.
So he gets recruited because he knows he's got to get through this wall to get down into the crypt.
Cool.
You know, not on like, don't imagine him on like on a cord, you know, like a Mission Impossible.
Oh, right,
like
lowering
him in. But obviously, you need to get through the wall. So, John of St. Albans is the first man who's recruited. Mm-hmm. And he, I don't know where they all met, but I'm guessing it's a pub. Because
he
is known to be, he was known around town as a bit of a drunk at this point. So,
I guess you need to find people who also aren't on the straight and narrow. You know, they need to be likely to commit a crime with you. A very big crime.
But the thing is, everyone who's anyone who's like in it to win it, is up in York. So the people who have been left behind are already disgruntled.
They're already the outsiders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But they're the grey men who you wouldn't see. The meet in the room kind of thing.
Yes.
Right? So you got him. But where do you go if you get caught.
If you get caught.
You need a bolt hole, don't you? You need somewhere to run away to.
Oh, I see. Right, yeah.
If it goes wrong, or even if it goes right, you need to have a safe house. Exactly. Yeah. So, you need... This is amazing. William Palmer.
Okay.
William Palmer was the deputy keeper of the Fleet Prison. The River Fleet is a river which runs under London now, but it used to be open air.
Right.
And it was covered over because it stank so much of sewage. But it's still there. It's underground.
So it stunk so bad, so they gave it a roof so the stink stayed inside.
Until it got out to the Thames.
Oh,
yeah,
gross.
I know. But anyway, so the Fleet Prison was notoriously bad because it was obviously, if it's by the River Fleet, it stinks. And so terrible sanctuary. But the deputy keeper of the Fleet was a mate, William Palmer.
Mm.
And he said he would shelter the burglars in the King's Palace because he had the keys whilst they were either going in or going out.
So William Palmer... Deputy
keeper
of a prison.
Yeah,
but he has the keys to the King's palace.
Yes, because he's a man of standing.
Oh, I see. So he's got a last name.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a big deal.
William Palmer.
That's very interesting. But so why does he have keys? So he's just, Is it like lots of people have keys to the King's
I imagine.
Palace?
Yeah, I imagine
he's not like the keeper of the keys of the King's palace. Yeah, it's a bit weird thing. But okay,
because also he would probably be up north,
and that's where they want to hide the King's palace.
Perfect place to hide.
Last place they'd look.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, probably steal more stuff. Yeah. Probably some rugs they could take.
So you've got William Palmer, keeper of the keys, if you like, keeper of the jail. Then you've got Jonathan Albans, who's your mason man,
the mason. Yeah.
And then you actually need someone who's good at breaking into places and actually is a criminal.
You need
some criminal enterprise. You can't just be a League of Gentlemen, if you like.
Yeah. You need someone who knows his stuff.
So you need a real villain, really. Okay.
you need the guy from Jaws. You know, the one who knows how to hunt shark. You know, you need that guy.
You do. And that man's name was John Rippingdale.
Oh,
what a name, right?
Also a last name.
Yeah.
So he would have been...
Or he might have been John of Rippingdale, actually.
Right, okay.
Rippingdale might be a place.
Rippingdale sounds like a place, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't
but
it?
But it does also sound like a criminal's name.
Rippingdale
sounds like a place you'd go to find criminals.
Yeah, it would. Maybe that's where he found him.
Apologies if anyone listening is from Rippingdale. It's a place that exists.
Yeah.
Or not. Maybe it is where criminals go.
Maybe, yeah.
Right. So two Johns as well.
Yes, John's of
English history.
John is fairly common.
Yeah.
So yeah, you got John of St. Albans, who's the mason, and John Rippingdale, who was known, he has an alias, the Chaplain.
Oh, love it. The Chaplain, great.
Yes. And the reason he's known as that is because he had a reputation of breaking into churches.
Oh, he's perfect.
I know. The man suits the job.
So you've got the Chaplain, you've got the mason, and you've got
Jailer.
The jailer. Oh, yeah. I love it.
And then you got Mr. Pudleycock.
Yeah, he doesn't get the leader never gets their own nickname. They're always the person. Yeah,
yeah, that's so true. So yeah, he was known as a chaplain because I'm presuming he would dress up as a chaplain, walk into churches or steal into churches and just nick the chalices from the top.
And this is still Catholic England, so it's not. Yeah, so you know, gold crosses, a lot of stuff. There's a lot of gaudy stuff.
Don't forget, it's the time of the Crusades, so you know it's really chic at the moment.
Would they have? No, they wouldn't have like Islamic stuff because anything they steal, they'd melt down and turn into crosses.
Well, they do have some things
really?
From over there. Yeah. Mm. Which might come out later. Or maybe not. So there you are. That's the crew. You've got William Palmer, who's the jailer. Jonathan Albans, who's the mason man.
The mason.
And John Rippingdale.
The chaplain.
There you go. And then there were others. People believe that there were definitely several goldsmiths.
Okay.
Who were probably acting as fences, but also they could melt down stuff so it's unrecognizable.
So you had the crew, but then the wider operation.
Yeah.
You know, the outside help, yeah.
And also there might have been some corrupt guards too.
Oh, okay.
Because it can't have just been those four.
They're not part of the crew though. They're just, they're just like outside interest. They would have probably, you know, they don't get a cut. They get paid.
Yeah.
You know.
So, the plan.
Okay.
You obviously have a mason man. 13 inches of really good stone. Think about Westminster Abbey.
13 inches, that's fucking big.
Yeah.
That's intense.
That is. That's half a metre, just over.
Yeah.
Like, it's fairly thick.
How tall as well are we thinking?
What do you mean?
It's funny. Oh, is this also in a building?
Yes, it's in the
trap house. It's not the building. Sorry, I understand.
Yeah. You've got the cemetery where the cloaked figures, William Palmer and everyone else, are in there. And then you've got this wall, and at the bottom of it, I'm presuming there was a hole, or they made a hole.
That's intense to get through, yeah.
I know. So, great plan. Mm-hmm. You've got the mason, check. you might have bribed a few guards. Check. You've got a bolt hole and like a headquarters in the jail if you need it. Mm-hmm. Check. And you have a expert criminal who's good at nicking stuff.
Yeah.
And he probably has contacts as well, as he in John Ripping.
He might have helped people pay off the guards, you know.
Yeah.
He knows. I imagine he's
probably
also
a muscle man as well.
Yeah, he's also the one you want to like come up with solutions on the fly because he's done this before. Everyone else is new to crime. He's the one who goes, no, you need to do that. He's the expert.
Exactly.
He's the consultant.
I don't imagine William Palmer being a deputy keeper of the prison to get on with the career criminal.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Yeah. That's. But, you know, maybe he's... Maybe, he
maybe they're all just a den of thieves. They probably are. But anyway, so how do you get through that wall? Obviously, it's quite noisy to go through a wall of 13 inches of stone. And the only access to it is through a graveyard. And graveyards are notoriously flat.
And quiet.
And quiet and open.
And people will get annoyed if you start making a lot of noise in there.
Yes, not including the people who are buried underneath you.
Exactly.
Yeah, and remember, superstition abound in this time. You had to be careful not to anger the spirits. Anyway, so there is one secret ingredient to this plan that makes it amazing.
And it's not explosives.
No, I can just imagine. Imagine you had the crew all set up. They're sitting around that table. And they go, yeah, but okay, Richard of Hardycott, how are we going to get to the wall without being seen? He takes out of his bag. He's just been to Costco or something. And he goes, with these. And he brandishes loads and loads and loads of hemp seed.
Oh my god.
And they must have all looked at him like, what the hell has he gone?
Wow.
So yeah, his whole plan rests on hemp seed.
To grow hemp.
Literally.
To surround the area.
Yeah.
Oh, I love this plan.
Yeah.
It's using nature.
There's no one around. Remember, everyone.
The gardeners are gone.
Alf's up in Scotland tending to Edinburgh Castle. Oh. Probably not Edinburgh Castle. But anyway, so he's up there in York. Yeah, York. Yeah, Clifford's Tower. So his plan is essentially to scatter loads and loads and loads of hemp seed all round the bit of the wall that they need to be hidden so that they can work without being seen. Now, this might sound ridiculous, but this is literally what they did. Because there was no one looking, because no one goes into the monk cemetery often, they let this hemp seed, apparently it took about 3 months to grow. So you just imagine them sort of turning up and like watching, peeping over. Yeah. Is it high enough? No. Had to come back next week.
Wow. And just hoping no one cuts it down, because then the plan's ruined.
Exactly. But because they know people, they probably know that that doesn't get tended. This is the thing, they're insiders. They know the system.
Also, I love the way that they're not taking plants from somewhere else and like burying them together, because that would be too obvious. You'd notice a change.
Yeah.
But just slowly growing hemp, people are like, there's always been hemp there. As far as I remember, there's been hemp there. It was definitely there yesterday. So what's the problem?
Very, very true. So that's the plan, basically, is over 3 nights, they think it'll take them. They're going to go all the way into the cemetery, presumably not all of them. I'm imagining everyone's on standby except for the mason and Richard of Pudleycott.
Yes, possibly the chaplain as well, just as a lookout.
Maybe as a lookout. And what they did was they very, very quietly worked away, chipping away. Because that's the other thing. You have to use the hemp to hide the hole that you're building.
Yeah.
Because you can't just like, do it in one night, so they have to have
Oh, they do
delay.
It slowly. They Shawshank it.
Yeah.
Ah.
But over 3 nights. And a Shawshank, I think, took months. But like,
which, no, it took, I think, like 12 years to do.
Whatever. Yeah. So this is a bit quicker than Shawshank.
Sure.
But so there they are, like tapping away at night. They only work at night.
But then also, is there not a danger that people inside would hear them?
Well, who goes down there?
Oh, I suppose it's only
it's the Royal
crypt.
Treasury.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, no
and
one.
And at night,
there.
Wow, very interesting.
So, when the guards are probably at their most tired as well, because there still would be guards out there, but they would have been asleep. And no one's guarding the monk cemetery.
No.
So, that's the thing. So, I'm going to leave that there before we go any further and tell you what's actually in the treasure.
Oh, great.
Because it's not just, you know, as I said, it's not just like gold bars. It's actually way more cool than that. So what's down there are all sorts of things. So most of the royal regalia of the Crown of England, as well as the crown jewels, are stationed
there. Crown jewels are there?
Well, yes, but he's obviously got some of it with him.
He's got his portable ones.
Presumably, yeah. But so there were jewels down there, silver and gold coins, obviously, goblets, jugs,
nice.
Chalices, cups. So far, it's like IKEA.
Goblets, cups, and chalices.
Sauces.
Basically the same thing.
Yeah, it's true. Sauces, spoons, and vases. But then, so leave all that to one side for a minute.
Basic stuff.
The unique treasures.
Oh, here we go.
The stuff you can't just melt down.
Yeah.
the Cross of Neath, which is I don't actually know what that is, but apparently it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. It's a big cross from Neath, yeah, yeah.
Another one, the Holy Cross of Holyrood, which is the Black Cross of St. Margaret from Scotland. So this is like something that's a war trophy that he's got.
A war trophy. Oh, yeah. Spoils of war. I suppose a lot of this will be spoils of war, won't it?
It will. Then there's the Scepter or the Rod of Moses, which is clearly a relic of some description.
Right, but presumably it will be made out of gold, and if Moses had a scepter, he wouldn't have a gold one, because that's not how story works. But
it's what you can sell it for. That's all that matters.
Or maybe it has wood in it, and it's like they've embossed it.
Maybe.
Christ.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
And then also a couple of other really cool things. There's the Sword of King Athelstan from the 9th century. So this is 500 years since the 9th century.
Is Athelstan the first king of England?
He absolutely is.
That one. Way. So there are magic swords. Well, not quite a magic sword. But
exactly,
a big deal of a sword.
And that sword reputedly cut through the Rock of Dunbar, which is kind of cool. So it's like a sword of legend.
It's the reverse Excalibur. It cut through a rock.
Exactly.
A rock didn't stop it.
Then there was something called the Sword of Wayland the Smith, which was last used to knight Henry II.
Wow.
So that's a really old sword as well. And the sword of the mythical Prince Tristan, which had been presented to King John, so the grandfather of Edward, by the Holy Roman Emperor. So some really...
Wow.
So there you are. There's your mythical sword.
Genuinely, yeah.
And also something else that I think is very good, and our Cloak and Dagger listeners will appreciate this, because also down there were personal possessions of Edward I. And one in particular...
No way.
What? You don't know what it is?
Oh, okay. I was going to guess what it was, but yeah.
Go on then, guess.
Is it going to be something to do with the assassins?
Yeah. No sort way. Of.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, in that crypt was also the dagger which was used in an attempt to assassinate Edward when he'd been resting in Acre.
No way.
Yeah.
Obviously, you were all the History of England listeners, so you won't know this, but our first ever episode, we did it on the assassins that existed in Syria in the Middle East during the Crusades. And, I mean, you told this story, but one of these assassins, who are from the Assassin's Creed game, if you played those, attacked Edward.
Yeah.
And failed, and he fought them off, got out of bed in his just sleeping clothes and stabbed a guy with a dagger.
With the dagger.
And this is the dagger?
Yes.
No way.
And then he kept it as a personal relic.
Oh my God.
I know.
Wow, he didn't take it with him. I would take that with you. Yeah. I'd have that on you at all times.
I suppose so, yeah. But anyway, yeah, so that dagger was also in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good... I mean... I suppose the other swords are probably, for us, that's a cooler take, but those other swords are probably a bigger deal.
Yeah, they probably are. Money. But still, like in terms of that, there's so much there for him to use. And you've got to remember also that there is obviously an abundance of coin as well. It's not just that.
Yeah, there's just a lot of cash.
Yeah. So the plan goes ahead.
This is probably a lot. Do we have any idea in like today's money how much that would have been worth?
Oh, yes, we do.
Oh my God, how much?
About £1 trillion.
No way.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, because back then, treasure was worth so much money. Like, you could buy an entire country out of that.
Yeah.
£1 trillion.
That's what makes this such an incredible story.
So this might be one of the biggest heists of all time.
Yeah, that's what I said at the beginning. I wasn't just
Not just English history, but of any history.
Possibly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the thing. That's what's down there. Now, obviously, he can't do it on his own, so he's got his crew.
Mm-hmm.
So, night 3... of the chipping away within the hemp,
mm-hmm.
and they make a breakthrough. Literally, they get in. Now, as far as we can tell, and you've got to remember, we're just relying on Richard of Pudlicott's own confession here.
Right.
So it's not like he's going to like give the praise to the other people.
Yeah.
But he got in there and on his own, or, you know, he went in, he was the only one who went into the crypt.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent the next 2 nights just in there with all the treasure.
That's baller. I love that. He's like, I'll just stay here for a bit.
Yeah.
What a time to be alive. Like, you know, that change of, you know, from the world around him is this a very, you know, very natural, but very impoverished world of, you know, feudal medieval world, England.
Yeah.
And then he just gets to hang out in basically heaven, like this place that would feel so unreal. It would be like, I genuinely don't think us today could have that jump in experience. There's nowhere on the planet, like, other than Like, even if we stayed a night in Elon Musk's house or the richest people in the world's house, I don't think it would be that amazing as what he went through.
Yeah.
To stay in a place with more money than most countries have anywhere. And you could, and it's not just... Because also most, you know, value nowadays isn't tangible. You can't see it.
No.
I guess it would be maybe just standing... I don't know.
You'd have to go to like the gold reserves and like gold, you know, in Goldfinger.
Yeah, something like that. But even then, it's still like, and then, but also because there's these swords of legend.
Yeah.
Like that's what would be amazing.
You can imagine him like waving them around and like putting on the crown.
So he went in there and just spent 2 days doing nothing.
No, he didn't. He was also taking things out. So he was using that human chain, as I said at the beginning, of getting it out to barges.
And you say, I mean, I understand it's his confession and there's a good chance that he was like bigging himself up. Or he wasn't ratting out his friends. Maybe there was bigger punishment. He said, no, I was the only one who stepped inside. Like maybe there's more punishment.
Possibly.
I don't know if the law is quite as lenient at that. Like, you know, you get lesser punishments or they just go, you're all hung.
Yeah, that's the thing. But hanged or hung. I never know which one it is.
Hanged. Definitely hanged.
Okay, definitely hanged. Okay. Well, so this happens. So they start taking all this stuff out of the crypt and they take it to the house by the fleet, which was the jailer's houses where they were keeping lots of things. But there was so much of it, and because they were pub friends, and they were probably alcoholics, they were getting drunk and splashing the cash very, really? Very obviously.
Oh, immediately started spending it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, bunch of amateurs.
Genuinely, like, London was suddenly filled with gold. It was just everywhere. It was washing up on the Thames, apparently.
Oh my God. What?
Because they got drunk and they dropped it into the side.
Maybe they're like, we're going to get caught. Like, why are we trying to be, why are we pretending this is probably going to be the end of our lives? Let's just go home. Let's spend everything. Let's live our lives to the fullest for the few months before old Longshanks come down and butchers us to pieces.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm not sure how... I hope they had a good time, because actually, weirdly enough, as I said, it washed up on the Thames, but it was also found behind tombstones as well, where they surmise they got drunk and they just kind of was like... They fell asleep in a graveyard and then left their booty there. So it was just being found by random
everywhere.
People. There was so much of it. This is the thing. It was so much
money.
I think
they would just be... you know, dumbstruck by the amount and have no idea how to deal with this. No. Like, it's just something unreal to them and they would just go a bit mad. Yeah. I love them also getting drunk still.
But what's so interesting is that the news, the reports were going up to Scotland. Mm. So they got to the ears of Edward, who was hearing that his personal belongings were being, like,
thrown about.
Yeah. So he was furious. Yeah. And he didn't come down straight away, but his administrators down there, obviously their heads are on the line. Can you imagine if you're, like...
Under your watch.
Yeah, the guard walks in and goes, I'm sure there was more in here last night.
So, yeah, so they're taking it bit by bit as well. So once they've made the hole is just there, it's just their door. It's not like they went in and took everything.
Yeah,
I suppose that makes sense, actually. Because someone probably isn't counting it every day.
No.
Actually, what would have made more sense, I mean, they've done it wrong. Either they should have stolen everything and just tried to get away as quickly as possible.
That's what they should have done.
Sail to Amsterdam or something.
Yeah.
Or they just slowly take money out. Use it to buy properties. Use it to buy stuff, you know, restart their lives like that. Don't take any of the noticeable stuff.
Yeah.
Because also you can't sell. Like, I'd like to buy this farm. What are you going to pay with? This sword was given to King John by...
And then you go, yeah, right.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'll knock off some of those rubies off it and buy it, but this is a bit weird. And you'd probably go, yeah, I might go tell someone about that because it's... But just take some of the gold and just go invest it.
That would have made so much more sense, but
they
didn't
really
do
boring
that.
And more exciting. And I think I probably would have done what they did.
Yeah, exactly. And so Edward basically was furious and he was known for his temper. Mm. So he arrested, get this, arrested all the monks of Westminster Abbey.
Wow.
Including the abbot. And there were like 48 of them. 48 monks and the abbot and palace officials were all arrested.
Just for missing it? Like just for being complacent? Not because he thought it was them?
No, he presumed it was them.
Oh,
because it was on their watch, you know. Right. And so he was pissed off. So he shoved them all in the Tower of London.
I imagine he's kind of like, even if it wasn't them who did it, I'm still annoyed at them.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And eventually they did catch up with all of them because they were known. This is the thing, the networks of people. All you'd have to do is torture one monk and suddenly you had the entire lot.
Yeah.
You know.
They didn't.
And they were splashing the cash.
I mean, if they got all the, you know, all the people from just the pub down the road, you know, you don't steal where you live as well. You know, you go somewhere else. So yeah. Not a well thought out plan.
No, one other person who was locked up was a man called John Cinch, who was the actual jailer of the Fleet. So you remember the deputy keeper was William Palmer.
He was deputy, yeah.
Cinch was also arrested. Mm. And so then what happens is they languish in prison for quite a while. It was only in the spring of 1305 that the king then came south after finishing his Scottish campaign, and he actually let all of the all the monks go because he'd calmed down by this point. Mm. But no such luck for our good friend Richard of Pudlicott, who was hanged.
Wow.
As we thought he would.
Just hanged.
Several of them were hanged. Yeah.
I suppose also tortured out to get a confession as well.
Yes.
Which is why we know about this.
I reckon he wasn't tortured. I reckon he wanted to tell his tale.
It's a pretty good story.
It is, isn't it? So he didn't want to, he wanted to avoid further scandal. If he'd hanged all of those abbots and things, then he would have issues.
Yeah, that's a rough gig, and you know, you don't want to get too far into that.
But interestingly, he did reappoint Cinch as the warden. Of the keeper of the keys,
really?
So he realised it wasn't him. So there must have been some really good investigation going on, but
or just the confession.
Yeah,
said, yeah, no, these are the guys that did it. So the other ones weren't hanged.
They were four people were hanged. The ones we know about.
The ones we know plus maybe some others. Yeah,
they were hanged. And there was a tale that went round that said that Edward had flayed the skin of Richard of Pudlicott off him and made it as a sort of skin to put on a door in Westminster Abbey.
Wow.
And this door was the door, I'm not sure if you saw it a while ago, but they said this is the oldest door in England.
And it supposedly has the skin of
Richard Pudlicott.
Wow.
They then, in 2005, did a study and they realised it was an animal skin. But the fact that legend had been created, that rumour, you did not want to
Edward. That at the time, like, some of the monks are going, yeah, they've been really quite, apparently being tortured. Someone even said he was being skinned, and someone went, you know that door that they just put that animal skin on?
Yeah.
You don't think, no. He could do it. Did you hear what he did to the Scottish?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just imagining, like, what if Richard Pudlicott had, like, an embarrassing tattoo on, like, somewhere?
Yeah,
my God, does that say, I love you, mum?
Yeah.
That's no animal.
Pudlicott forever.
Yeah, exactly. That is our tale.
Wow.
The tale of one of the greatest robberies in English history and one of the worst ways of, like, the aftermath.
The heist was fantastic. I think the planning was great. I loved the crew. I think they did a phenomenal job. They just didn't know how to spend it. Or maybe they did and they just knew it's not worth. Because even if they'd taken all of it and flown. I suppose you can say because he's fleeing.
Flee,
fools. He flew across the channel, made it to France, made it to Amsterdam, managed to escape somehow.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to get away forever, you know.
No.
Other kings of Europe will also send their men to kill, because they don't want this happening.
Or they may laugh.
Yeah, or they want to go steal that money.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Like, I imagine, that's... yeah, if he'd taken all this, like, you know, proper loot that was like all the stuff that the King of England had, I bet the Dutch would have loved to have that, or King of France.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that would have been a better plan. But unfortunately, that's not what happened. And poor Richard of Pudlicott, what a life he led, might have wanted to stick to butter. But hopefully he had a good time in that crypt. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. I would just like to say that I referenced, apart from Jammy History Podcast, which was bloody brilliant, there was one article in particular that I used, which was by Marjorie Bassett, called The Fleet Prison in the Middle Ages, University of Toronto Law Journal, 1944. And that's the most recent academic journal that I could find who did a piece on this. So if you want to learn more, it's on JSTOR, as I'm sure many of you already have free accounts there. If you haven't, get on it. It's brilliant.
It's where we do all our research.
Yes. And if you did enjoy listening to that, you will find us on any of your, wherever you get your podcasts. We're on the iTunes, we're on Spotify and Amazon Music as well. So yeah, all that's left to do is thank you for listening. And Patrick, thank you for being there too.
Thank you very much. This was an amazing story. We always love a good heist.
We do. And thank you, David. And we are looking forward to what's happening in your podcast too. Cheers.
Cheers.